I thought I would discuss something from the fourth canto, Srimad Bhagavatam. We have some students here, they probably need a little background. You've seen this before? This is one of about 30 volumes of one book, one volume of many parts, called Srimad Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam means in relation to Bhagavan, Krishna. Narrations of histories in relation to Krishna. And the Srimad part means beautiful. And the section, it's one of the principal Puranas. Purana means history, old history. And in this old history, there is a description of the lineages of kings coming from the Manus. And just a little background for college students. Manu is a name of the lawgiver of mankind. And according to the Vedic picture of time, there's cycles of four yugas, like four seasons. They cycle around and around and around, like the four seasons. And one complete cycle of those four yugas is 4,320,000 years. 4,320,000 years. That's one cycle. And 72 in a fraction of those cycles makes the day of one Manu. It's a long period of time, in other words. And then there's 14 Manus in the day of Brahma. So Brahma is the first, according to the Vedic picture of what happened before we took birth, what went on, what's the old, what went on before we came around. This evening we're going to be speaking about one of the verses from the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. And at the beginning of the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna states something that's very obvious. One cannot know what existed before you existed, because it existed before you existed. You can't know. You can speculate, but you can't know. Even if the greatest of sages and the demigods and the forefathers and the great rishis and can't know, unless there's one event and that's it's disclosed from that which existed before you existed, then you can know. So Krishna says, I'm now going to disclose that I existed before everything existed. So Krishna discloses what existed before we existed, and what I'm describing is that disclosure. Within the Srimad Bhagavatam, the first born living being is Lord Brahma. And keeping it very concise, his principal service is twofold: to create, or he's the chief engineer. He puts the universe together. And then at the end of each night, there's a partial devastation, and he rebuilds that which is partially devastated. And he does that for his lifetime. And then when his lifetime is over, the universe is withdrawn. Total devastation. That's one of his functions, the chief engineer or creator of the universe. He does so through the power of the Supreme who existed before he existed. And the second thing that he does is he manifests the Vedas. He manifests, Veda means knowledge, the knowledge of how to operate the machine. Like when you get some technology thing, electronic thing. You get the thing and you get a little operator's manual. So the Vedas is the operator's manual. How you use this thing, creation, in such a way that the purpose of creation is fulfilled. And if you don't use the operator's manual, good chance you use the technology device, electronic device, in a way that it's not designed for. Unless you read the manual. Become familiar with the manual. Have some of you train you up how to use the manual, how to use the machine, the creation, in a proper way. Because the proper way brings one to a position where you're free from samsara, the cycle of birth and death. That's to return to the eternal realm where there's no creation, and there's no devastation, and there's no in-between old age and death. Oh, liberation, moksha, or apavarga, situated in timelessness, eternal life. That's the user manual's objective. That's the purpose of the creation. Return us to that position. So during, there's, Brahma lives, according to Bhagavad Gita, for 100 years. And those 100 years are made up of days. Each day of Brahma has 1,000 yuga cycles. Each one 4,320,000. Each of the yuga cycles times 100. That's one day. But each of those days is divided up into 14 manos. He invests authority in manus, like kind of like a cabinet. You know, the chief of state's got his cabinet, and he's in charge of the law department. He gives the laws for mankind how to live their life. And there are other agents that they're the law enforcers. Yamaraj has his team, the law enforcement team. And during each of those manus, one of the topics in Srimad Bhagavatam, there's a list, 10 topics, and one of those topics is the manus and the lineage of kings that come from those manus. So I'm going to be speaking about one of those kings that came from the first of the manus. The first of the manus, his name is Swayambhuva Manu. And that topic begins in the beginning of Canto 3, Swayambhuva Manu, and the lineage that comes from Swayambhuva Manu. Before I go into that's a backdrop, and then we're going to start putting in the figures in the painting. But before I do that, there's something that's kind of like a backdrop of the backdrop. What, 2 points. One point is, something that I heard Srila Prabhupada say on a number of occasions. I'm going to say it in two different ways. One is that one of the principal responsibilities or duties of a spiritual master or a spiritual teacher is to convey to the student or disciple very clearly. Sometimes repetition is necessary for clarity, so with great clarity, that fruitive activity in this plane of existence is completely futile. It's illusory. Chasing after water in a desert. It's illusory. Don't chase after water in a desert, because a desert means there's no water. So don't look for water in a desert. So say it as many times in different ways, but the abject futility of pursuing happiness through fruitive activity is a primary lesson that one who's teaching or training others, guiding others in spiritual life, must do. And there are different ways to do it. You can do it nicely, you can do it starkly, you can do it in story form, you can do it with a hammer, you can do it so many different ways. But it's a lesson that must be learned. And so, repeatedly again and again and again and again and again and again, so that it's a very clear lesson. Pursuing happiness in a place where there's no happiness is a fool's paradise. Don't go down that path. Or as they say these days, there's no cheese down that hole. So don't go for it. Another way of saying the same thing is, I didn't hear this many times, but sometimes Prabhupada spoke that a spiritualist is materially pessimistic and spiritually optimistic. Or a devotee is materially pessimistic. I don't have a great expectation for finding happiness in material existence. I've learned a number of lessons over a course of many lifetimes, and I don't have this great expectation. Charles Dickens wrote a book about great expectations, and guess what? They got frustrated. So, even Charles Dickens is teaching the same thing. So a spiritual instructor, Krishna in Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, and anyone representing those literatures, will convey this message. Material pessimism, spiritual optimism. And the materialist is just the opposite. Materially optimistic, spiritually pessimistic. Let's say an agnostic. Materially optimistic. Spiritually pessimistic. I don't know about that. This is the show me state, right? Missouri? Show me God. If you can't show me God, well, see you later. Till you can show me God. Anyway, materially optimistic. So, in this section that I'm going to be discussing, there's this is a major part of the message to one king. The message being delivered by Narada to a king. And it's, that's a theme. Fruitive activities, boo. And there is an alternative. So this is Narada's message. Then the second kind of backdrop to the backdrop is Sankhya. Just while taking breakfast, I was listening to Prabhupada explain the etymology of Sankhya. And it kind of, the root is something. Somebody knows Sanskrit? Something is, I think it's Sankhya, which means count. And the act of counting is Sankhya. So, literally it means counting. So, the divisions of matter, analysis of the divisions of matter, and on the other side, the realm of spirit. And Sankhya is analyzing matter and spirit. Prabhupada gave the example, just as the Bhagavad Gita verse, though the eight separated material energies, earth, water, fire, air, ether, that's five, mind, intelligence, false ego, that's another three, five and three is eight. There's eight separated material energies, that's Sankhya. That's in chapter 7, Bhagavad Gita. Or simpler, chapter 2, there's there's sat and there's asat. There's eternal and there's temporary. So there's these two, and then there's eight. And then in chapter 13, there's 24. It's just a different system of more complete analysis, more refined analysis. Like looking up a word in a pocket dictionary, looking up the same word in a Webster's, Collegiate, Oxford, Cambridge, you know, blah, blah dictionary. The same word with the same meaning, it's just expanded, refined shades of meaning of the word. So there's an element in this section of Sankhya. And Sankhya, in addition to analyzing the elements of matter, there's this cause and effect of you wiggle something over here and it's connected to something over here, so something over here wiggles. And when this one wiggles and that one wiggles and when that one wiggles and another one wiggles, and you get life where things are moving. But there's an original cause. And the original cause, that from which all the forms and varieties of the separated energy emanate, there's the original cause, and then that original cause produces an effect, which then becomes a cause of the next downstream effect, which becomes the cause of the next downstream effect, and you get varieties of existence. So you can analyze and go back and back and, aha, there's the cause, but that cause is an effect of something. And that is then the cause of, but that cause is, has a prior cause, it's the effect of something. So the search of the Vedas is, what's the cause of all causes? And that's considered, in Vedic language, the absolute truth. So the absolute truth is that which has no other cause and is the cause of all other causes. Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchitananda Vigraha Anadir Adir Govinda Sarvakarana Karanam, the cause of all causes. And what's that? Krishna. The Sri Brahma Samhita declares Krishna is the cause of all causes. So Srimad Bhagavatam is helping us to understand when we see events and kind of jump into the pool of trying to be a fruitive enjoyer of events, we're missing something. We're missing the cause of all causes. So Narada is, from the very beginning of the... So now I'm going to go into the history part. The history starts in the beginning of Canto 3 with the first Manu, Swayambhuva Manu. And Swayambhuva Manu has two sons and three daughters. Swayambhuva Manu's wife is Shatrarupa. And the eldest son, firstborn son, commonly in Vedic culture, he becomes the king, the successor to his father. And the firstborn son was Priyavrata. And Priyavrata was very spiritually inclined, and he made the request when he was eligible to become the king, he was of age to become the king, he requested his father, may my younger brother become the king instead. I'd like to go to the forest, detach myself from worldly existence, and just perfect my spiritual life. So his father consented. So Priyavrata went to do that. And the younger brother was named Uttanapada. And so this is a detailed description. But Uttanapada became king. He had two wives. One of the firstborn son was Dhruva, and the description of Dhruva's life. And then Dhruva becomes king, and Uttanapada also becomes liberated. And Narada is involved in all of this. In the third canto, there's the daughters are described first, which is nice. So the first of the daughters is Devahuti, and Devahuti's marriage with Kardama Muni, that detail is described, and what they did living in the forest together. A princess becomes the wife of a qualified, an amazing yogi, Muni, Kardama Muni. And some daughters are born, and Kardama Muni, Kapila Dev is born, and the teachings of Kapila Dev to Devahuti, big section of the third canto. Then there's two other sisters, Akuti and Prasuti, that's described briefly. And then the Uttanapada narration, Dhruva Maharaj. And following Dhruva Maharaj, then he became king, and his praja, his descendants were also delivered. The whole long line of kings coming down and down and down, where Narada, he is, there's many unique features of Narada Muni. Narada, his life spans over many, 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 many generations. In fact, he lives for a whole day of Brahma. And that's a long time. 1,000 times 4,320,000. Because his body is spiritual. Doesn't deteriorate like material bodies deteriorate. So he's the preceptor or the guru of generations and generations, and an awesome line of kings, until it comes towards the end of the fourth canto of the Bhagavatam, where there's one of those kings that, unlike his predecessor kings, he's a little mixed. He's not fixed in pure devotion. He's interested also in fruitive activities. Religious kind. He's interested in sacrifices that are described and found within the Vedas, and he's really keen on those. So Narada decides to deliver him, to pay him a visit. So he visits the king. The king is a very pious man, very religious man. So he receives Narada appropriately, as a cultured person receives a great saintly person. So there's Narada seated on a elevated seat, and the king is at his feet, looking up at Narada and asking, please guide my life. I require training and teachings. So Narada is, so another gift of Narada besides his life is very, very long, is he's specifically empowered. He's a Shaktivesh avatar. He's empowered to deliver pure devotion, directly empowered by Krishna to do that. And he has the purity to do that, and he has the gift of empowerment to do that. And along with that gift of empowerment comes discernment. He can understand his audience. He can understand who he's speaking to and how to best assist the person who he's speaking to go beyond their limitations, go beyond their conditionings to a stage where they can attain spiritual perfection. So by being with the king, who he knew ahead of time was too much attached to fruitive activities, he decided to help the king out of that bewildered condition by telling a story. Because it's real easy to hear stories. Children can hear stories and be happy. But the purpose of telling the story was, actually it was a story about himself. He just didn't say, this is you, by the way, King Prajinivari. This is a story about your life. He didn't start with that. He just told them a story. Once upon a time, there was a king. And the king's name became a different name. The king's name was Paranjan. And Paranjan was just like the person he was speaking to. He was very pious. Because he was very pious, his kingdom was prospering. And because his kingdom was prospering, the people in his kingdom were very happy. Everybody likes to be prosperous. And everything, his treasury was abundant, there weren't aggressive other kings trying to conquer him, he had a powerful army, he was engaged in religious activity, and everything was great, except there's always something. He didn't have a queen. So, what's a king without a queen? So he went and searched for a queen. High and low and sideways, up and down. He couldn't find a suitable queen. Then one fine day, he saw her from a distance. There was a woman in a beautiful garden, and she was bouncing a ball, and so on and so forth. And he, you know, Cupid's arrows got him, and he went up and approached this beautiful woman and started some conversation. And so then there's this, you know, a whole thing unfolds. If with a king and a queen, you got to have a palace, and you have to have children, you got to have, you know, the whole thing. So it describes after describing it's the whole section is about 375 pages. Some of you are students, and you write a paper for your classes sometimes, and how, you know, you write a 20-page paper. How long does it take you to write a 20-page paper? Some time. Imagine writing a 100-page paper, or 200, 300, 400-page paper. This section that I'm describing, in summary, is 375 pages long. It's a very substantial portion of Srimad Bhagavatam, because it's important. Because Nara is instructing in these matters of Sankhya and detachment from fruitive activities. So after narrating the whole thing, he becomes attached to his queen. There's an attack on the palace. He gets wounded. There's a whole thing. And, you know, eventually he dies. And when he dies, he thinks of his queen. And because he thinks of his queen at the time of death, in his next life, he takes on a female body. Like it's described in later in the fifth canto, when another king, Jad Bharat, when he died, he thought of a deer. So in his next life, he became a deer. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Yam yam vapi smaran bhavam chajantante kalevaram. Smaran means remember, and bhavam means your mood or your emotion. Whatever it is that the mind is fixed on at the time of death, Krishna says, that state you will attain without fail. Though think of the different options of what the mind might go to. And depending upon what the mind might go to, that state you will attain. Just a little anecdote in the middle of this. I had this memorable experience one time when I was returning back to our temple in New York from book distribution. And the location where I was at in book distribution, I had to take the subway to get back to the temple. In fact, it was take the A train to J Street Borough Hall and then take the F train. I had to switch platform, you know, go out of the car on the platform and get the next train to go to the next stop. So when I got off the train, this was so like at 8 o'clock at night, there was a big crowd of people on the platform. And I, you know, got close to see what it was, and there was a man dying on the platform. Like, writhing. And the people around said, "Hey man, what would you like? Just say it and we'll get it for you." He said, "Can I have a cigarette?" "Get the guy a cigarette. Get the guy." So they lit up a cigarette, and he, you know, feebly reached his hand and took a puff on the cigarette. "Is there anything else that you want?" "I want Sally." And then he was gone. So immediately I thought, okay, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, whatever the mind is fixed on at the time of death, that's the state you're going to attain without fail. So hope you found Sally. Or, but where one is attached, now the mind, the principle that's described in the Vedic literature, is the gross body is no longer fit for habitation, but the subtle body is there. Subtle body means mind, more subtle intelligence, more subtle false ego, those three. The subtle body then carries the soul on the strength of what the mind is fixed upon to the next situation. Where, so the soul is being carried by the subtle body, and that soul and subtle body enter into the womb of the next mother. Whether it's a mosquito, or a tree, or a human being, or a demigod, or whatever, depending upon what the mind is fixed on at the time of death. And so it's the modes of nature are acting on the subtle body. So King Paranjana in his next life becomes a woman. But because in his previous life as the king he was pious, he then gets this special privilege that his devotional or his spiritual interest becomes greater, and in that body as a woman, he moves on the path of spiritual activity and becomes a perfected soul and becomes liberated. So at the end of hearing, it's a couple hundred pages worth of description. At the end of that description, the king says to Narada, "That was a fascinating story, but I don't get it." Could you explain it to me, please? That my consciousness is covered. And I know that my consciousness is covered because I don't get it. And so, in another long sequence, Narada explains item by item. He retells the whole story and says, the king, Paranjana, indicates you, or generically, one who desires happiness through fruitive activity. But in order to fulfill desires for fruitive activity, you have to have material intelligence. So that's represented by the queen. She's the material intelligence. And then the doting king becomes subservient to the material intelligence, the queen. And then, you know, the whole rest of the city of nine gates that was built in order for you to have your nice happy life with your queen, or Paranjana with his queen, that's this body. Body has nine gates. There are nine holes or openings in the body. That goes through the whole thing. The serpent inside is the life air, or prana, and so on and so on and so on. He tells it very clearly. The message is that you, my dear king, or anyone who's seeking for happiness and fruitive activity, will find the opposite. You'll find unhappiness and an undesirable outcome after the whole show is finished. And then the king says, I don't get it. And it's clear why he doesn't get it. You know, he doesn't want to get it. That's why he doesn't get it. Have you ever had the experience of explaining something to somebody and they clearly don't get it, and it's clear that why they don't get it is because they don't want to get it? And he doesn't get it, doesn't want to get it, because he's attached. And he doesn't want to let go of the attachment. You know, attachment to fruitive activity is deeply seated, even if one takes up spiritual life, or go one step easier, religious life. Do religious activity because it'll make me more pious. And when one is more pious, one gets fruits of piety, and that fruits of piety bring wealth and beauty and knowledge and good birth and all kinds of nice things, which then make me, give me facility for enjoyment. Largely, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, and I've done little sample surveys here and there, it's true, most people think that the purpose of religion is what I just described. Enjoy piously. Don't enjoy the other way, but by all means enjoy, but enjoy piously. And enjoy piously in this life, and the reward for so doing is in the next life you enter into a heavenly realm where you enjoy even more opulently for a longer duration of time. And what Krishna describes in Bhagavad Gita is when that longer duration of time passes and your pious activities are exhausted, then you again come back to the earthly realm, take birth again, and go through the Ferris wheel program one more time. Just keep around and around. And that's if you're pious, because the other one goes boo, 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 and going down. That's also described in all religious teachings. So don't be that kind. The scriptures teach, be this kind. But what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, don't be either one of them. Abhrama bhuvanaloka purnar arvarta norjana. Neither try for the higher birth in the higher regions of creation, nor enter into the lower regions of creation, because therein repeated birth and death take place. O Arjuna, be transcendental to all of them. Go beyond the modes of nature. Trigunya Vishaya Veda Nish Trigunya Bhavarjana. Very simple. Trigunya Vishaya Veda. The Vedas speak mainly of, Vishaya means enjoyment. It's, you know, sense enjoyment. Sense enjoyment is what is the, that's the carrot for fruitive workers. So Vishaya, Trigunya Vishaya Veda. The Vedas deal mainly with enjoying in the three modes of nature. Nishtrigunya Bhavarjuna. Rise above those three modes of nature. That's by letting go of the mood of trying to be the enjoyer of them and the products of the modes of nature. Rather, instead, there's an alternative. And that alternative is Krishna should be the enjoyer of his energy, because it's his energy. He's the source of it. And if you follow the operator's manual, you can use this creation in such a way that it's for the satisfaction of the source of the creation. So back to King Prajinibari, he says to Narada, my consciousness is covered. I'm too much attached to the bodily conception of life and thinking myself of the enjoyer of the body and the fruits of my activity. And for that reason, I'm paraphrasing here, but I know you're speaking about me and for the benefit of me, but I just have to be honest and I don't get it. So then Narada says, okay, I'll give you another analogy, and it's much shorter. It's just like five verses. And he speaks about a deer that's in a beautiful park, garden. And he's with the she-deer, his companion. And there are beautiful flowers, soft grasses, the singing and buzzing of bumblebees. And he's enjoying the atmosphere of this nice garden space, not seeing that in front of them there's a tiger waiting to pounce on him and finish him. And behind him there's a hunter with a sharp arrow ready to fire the arrow. Because he's so much indulging himself in the scene of happiness, he doesn't recognize these perils. And then he very quickly describes that this metaphor of the deer is one who wants to be the enjoyer of the atmosphere surrounding him, but in front there's time, and time is the destroyer of all things. Time is like the tiger for the deer, and it's not just some people, there's a tiger. Time is acting on everybody, and tick, 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 it's finished. It's just however many ticks, and it's finished. And behind is the Lord of Death, Yamaraj, who's waiting for the opportunity to take that fruitive worker who has misused this valuable human form of life, because the human form of life has meant for self-realization, not for fruitive activity. It says that in the operator's manual. If you read the operator's manual, it's very clear. That's the purpose. But not even asking the question what to speak of reading the operator's manual, people don't know. In that condition of ignorance, they're misusing this valuable human form of life, and the Lord of Death is going to take that subtle body and the gross body to its next destination, where there is misfortune waiting. So the king says, I think I get it. I'm paraphrasing. I think I get it. I just wonder why those who were guiding me in the course of my fruitive activity by religious means never told me these things. They never told me these things. And so I've been misguided, but now what you're saying, I think I get it. But I have a doubt about what you just described, and that is, listen carefully, it gets a little subtle because I'm going to go into details now. He said if fruitive activities are done with a particular body, and from that particular body karma is accrued, and then the body expires and then the soul is transferred to another body, how is it that in the next body we can be held responsible for something that another body did that isn't even around anymore? I don't see how that works. Can you explain to me how it works? And Narada says, very good question. Here's how it works. The soul is not just in a gross body, but the soul is more exactly within the subtle body. Mind, intelligence, and false ego. And when the activity from the previous body is performed, there's impressions, sense impressions that go to the mind. This is, I'll elaborate a little bit. This isn't in all of what Narada says, but the mind is like a switchboard operator. Now, in our modern days, we don't have those people, but I remember seeing them going to offices in Manhattan, and there's a lady, there's a light flashing, and she puts a plug in over here, and they say, can you get an extension over there? And she plugs in over there. That's the mind. Here comes a signal from the senses that says, I want something to eat, or, you know, I want to something. I want to see something, touch something, smell something, hear something. Sense perception. And it goes to the mind. And the mind connects, you know, with the active sense to get that something. Not only the mind makes that connection between the senses of knowledge and the senses of action. So there's 11 senses, 5 and 5 and 1. 5 knowledge-acquiring senses, 5 working senses, and the mind, 11 senses total. That's in Sankhya. But there's an impression stored in the mind of that sense impression and the action. And it's something like a very, very expertly designed, subtle storage system. Subtle storage system. Something like, you know, like digital. You take an image, and you store it in your digital device, like a digital camera. And how many images can you store in a digital recorder? A lot of them. Depends how many gigabytes of storage space. But the mind's got like gigabytes and gigabytes of storage space. And it's very subtle impressions. And they just stay there. Dormant. Tick, tick. Time passes. And after some time passes, then that impression comes in the form of a reaction, of a thought or a desire. And to fulfill the desire, you need instruments, senses of action. And so material nature supplies the senses of action according to the desire that you have, and it's called the body. So you get another body. So this present gross body is the result of the previous gross body actions. And it's described like this. It goes boom, 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 boom. So the present body, Narada says, the face is the index to the mind. So when somebody's happy, you say, you can tell something about their state of mind. Somebody's sad, you can, by their the face, you can tell something about what's going on in the mind. And then he says that something that's going on in the mind is the result of, it gives an indication of something that happened in the past that caused that state of mind. The example is given, he gives the example of anger. Supposing there is anger in the mind. Now, anger has its cause. That's described in Bhagavad Gita. This is Sankhya, so just, but we're going to get to Krishna, don't worry. Passion, when the soul contacts the mode of passion, Rajoguna, the mode of passion, desire, I want to enjoy, that's the fruit of the soul contacting the mode of passion. And then that passion, when it's not fulfilled, the desire that's unfulfilled results in anger or frustration. So then the mind is connected to the senses, or the senses are connected to the mind. So it's described by Narada, when the mind is connected to the facial features, it shows anger. Or when the mind is connected to the hand, it shows as a cleansed fish. And when the mind in the state of anger is connected to the leg, it shows kicking. When the mind is connected in anger, is connected to the tongue, it comes out in the form of harsh speech. It's not, it's involuntary, it just happens. You can see someone got a clenched fist. They don't have to think about it. They don't think, I'm going to make my fist. It just happens. It's the mind connected to the instruments, the senses of action. So when you see, so then he says, that physical in this body tells you something about the mind. And the state of mind tells you something about the mind either in this life or in the previous life. There's some deposited impression, sense impression that's stored. And I'm sure we've all had the experience, certainly those who chant have had this experience. When you're sitting there chanting, all of a sudden some thought comes into your mind. You don't even know where it's coming from. Or when you're daydreaming, you're just, you know, the mind is just going, and something comes into your mind. Or an example, another example is dreaming. Because that's what dreams is, the gross body, present one, is just lying there. It's not doing anything. But the subtle body is doing something. And what the subtle body is doing is it's reviewing the photo file. And some image over here, some image over here, put the two together and you get a movie. It's called your dream. See, Narada says, even in our present life, in a dream, someone may be a king. Or the same someone may be a dog. Or someone may be a bird flying in the sky. And you're looking down and seeing, you know, what's... But the present body is just lying on the bed. And... Or on the floor, or wherever you lie. And the mind is in another body. And that's even in our present life. And then the subtle body comes back to this body, and then boom, I'm Mr. So-and-so, and these are my duties of life. And you start doing those things. Where does all of that come from? It's a memory stored in the mind. The example that's given is mud that has organic material within the mud. And as the organic material decomposes, some carbon dioxide or methane or whatever it is forms, a little gas forms, because there's mud, it's just a pocket of gas in the mud, and as it makes some pressure, eventually it'll burst through the layers of the mud, it'll come wiggling up to the top and the surface of the water, sit there for a moment, and enter into the air. And we see it all the time. You go to a little pond where there's some mud in the bottom. Like that, the mind is the mud. And the event, the impressions are like the decomposing organic material. And time passes, tick, 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 tick. And it's just stored there in a dormant condition. Very innocent, just hanging out. But tick, tick. And slowly, that impression comes in the form of a thought or a desire. And then that comes to our conscious awareness, and then we need material intelligence to, hey, you know, I've got this desire. How do I fulfill this desire? And if we pay attention to that thought or that desire, it takes over our life. It becomes our life. Someone just, Shyamasundar Prabhu, a disciple of Prabhupada, who is an astrologer, just forwarded a little YouTube, just this morning, connection to a past life remembrance of somebody from Glasgow, England, and a little boy who remembered his previous life from some remote island in, you know, 5 hours away, an island. It takes hours to get there by boat. But he was insisting when he was two, when he can first little babble, who he was and where he used to live and his two sisters and his brother and his family and all the details. And, you know, the parents thought, little boy, this is cute. And he just kept on and on and on. And then it got eventually 3 years into this whole narrative, where relatives came and uncles came, and people, they thought, what's wrong with this boy? He started getting like emotionally upset. He wanted to go back and visit his place and see his brothers. And he took them right to the place where the grave of his father was, and on and on and on. Just like those impressions are there. Sometimes they come to the surface and sometimes they don't. Some people have past life remembrances and some people don't. Their dialect, the Glasgow dialect, was a little hard for me to understand. But they were saying, you know, disbelief, disbelief, this is, you know, I don't know where our son is getting this, but he kept saying it, and maybe there's something to this. And then they brought others and they brought a psychiatrist. And so they eventually went to the place. And just as he had described elaborately over and over, and pointed to the places where he had lived in his previous life. So those impressions, the point is, those impressions are stored, whether they come to the surface or they don't come to the surface. One example that Prabhupada gives is, supposing in a dream, you dream of a golden mountain. His premise is, it's stated in the Bhagavatam by Narada specifically, even in your dreams, you can't dream of something that you have not already experienced. because it's stored in the mind, it comes together. So if you dream of a gold mountain, it means somewhere you experienced gold, somewhere you experienced a mountain, and you fuse them together like splicing film, and there's a golden mountain. It's not that there is a golden mountain or you saw a golden mountain, but those are part of your past experience, and here comes the fusion, golden mountain. I remember as a child having this, not just child, as a young adult, having a dream of the backyard where a place where we used to live, and I was, circling around, flying. It was just a repeated dream. I thought, what's that all about? I was looking for some deep meaning to it or something, but the configuration of the backyard and the garden and stuff where we played ball and stuff like that, you could see it from a bird's eye view. So somewhere was this and somewhere was that. So somewhere in some previous, Prabhupada writes in the purport, either you were a demigod or an astronaut. Or a bird or something flying. And because you can't have that dream, you can't have that impression, even in a dream, so without having the experience. So now, what's driving, so we'll get to the punchline of the fruitive activities. What Narada is saying to the king is, by these fruitive activities, all that you're doing is binding yourself by mental impressions, sensual impressions, feeding those desires, and building more impressions for future desires, which means future bodies. You're guaranteeing yourself another prison sentence, another embodiment. When the real object, if you bring the mind to, is the Supreme Pure. And so the real mission is to purify the subtle body, mind, intelligence, and false ego. And that's accomplished by bringing the mind to that which is pure. The real purpose of the Vedas, here's the punchline, the real purpose of the Vedas is to always remember Krishna. He doesn't say it so bluntly, but the real purpose of the Vedas is to purify the mind and purify the intelligence and purify the ego, so that there's a true sense of who you are, that's ego. There's a true sense of what intelligence is, that's how to go on the path to reach eternal life. And pure sense of the mind, always remember the Supreme Pure. And you practice like that instead of these fruitive activities, and that's going to be your destination. You'll actually achieve the mission of human life. So he advises the king, let go of these fruitive activities. Just let go. That's easier said than done, to let go of the expectation that I'm going to find happiness in a place where there's no happiness. Because we're addicted to it. And if we let go of that, where are we? And that's one of Arjuna's doubts in Bhagavad Gita. Supposing I follow what you're saying, Krishna, and I don't make it, then I'm neither there nor here. I'm nowhere. So what about that? And Krishna says, don't worry. That little progress that you made towards the spiritual destination, that's your eternal asset. Svalpam apyasya dharmasya trayate mahatobayat. It will save you from the greatest danger, going down in the lower species of life. It'll guarantee you that in your next life, if you don't complete, that you'll continue where you left off. Because it's a permanent asset for you. That's what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. So there's this, one last, just put the pieces together, assemble them one more time. Sankhya is the connection, it's an analysis of the divisions of matter, starting from the source of matter. So let's take modern science that says, mechanistic science says there's only one thing, there's matter, and the laws that govern matter, and there isn't anything else. one of our devotees was attending a science conference, and he said a question was asked at the end. It was an evolution science conference, and the question was, if matter, all there is matter and the laws that govern matter, where did matter come from? Where did the first matter come from? You have an idea that there's dead matter and somehow it gets complex and comes together and becomes living matter. Leaving that aside, where did the matter come from? And the answer given was, we don't know, but we know we don't have to have God in the picture to explain where matter came from. So, Sankhya says there is matter, and there's the push and pull, the cause and effect of matter. And so something way downstream here, where this wiggles, you can know that it, ahead of it, upstream, there's something else that wiggled, and something else, and something, and there's the original cause. Again, just this morning I heard Prabhupada describing it's like a train. There's the locomotive part of the train, and there's the cars. And the locomotive moves, and he made the sound. You know, the next car moves, because the locomotive is moving. But have you ever seen a bunch of cars just move on their own because the complex matter is there and they should just move? You know, just by chance they move. Or whatever, it takes, even you have a locomotive, it takes the person running the locomotive to move the train. It takes life to move matter. So that's Sankhya. By the touch of spirit, matter moves. And then there's the sequence of, it's called scientific research or technology, or, you know, the push and pull of something. You learn the push and pull of something at the university and you get a job and make a living because you learn the push and pull of something. You can make, you know, different devices and sell it in the marketplace through marketing and have a livelihood. But what about, where did it all begin? It doesn't matter where it all began, just make a living and get old and die, and that's it. So the message of the Vedas is for a person who asks the question, you know, what's it all about? What's the purpose of all of this push and pull, the cause and effect, and is there some purpose behind it besides we get old and die and in between we do some stuff? Try to enjoy fruit of activities. So as Narada is speaking like this to the king, it's actually the Bhagavatam is speaking like that to us. And the persons representing the Bhagavatam wish, myself included, wish to pass on that message. There's a very fascinating network that Narada unfolds in the Sankhya portion. You know, thigh bones connected to the hip bones connected to this bone, like that little riddle or song. And there's a cause and effect of things. And it's fascinating. And it's described in science and it's described in Sankhya. But real science is to know what's the cause that makes the whole thing come to be. Like if there's laws of nature, laws of matter, where do laws come from? And who enforces the law? And where the matter come from? Who makes the matter move? You know, like to get a series of events, what's the first movement of matter that then caused an effect that became the cause of another effect? And, you know, the train that's moving, called life. Where does it come from? And it's not just, you know, an abstract philosophical question. It directly impacts how we view our lives. You know, we're in the beginning there's birth, and the end there's death, and what do we put in between? How do you view life? Your life. How is life supposed to be lived? Is there a purpose to it? Beside the push and pull. The cause and effect, and you know how you arrange things to get positive fruit of activity, so you get sense gratification in between birth and death. Is that the program? Is that all there is to it? And there's nothing more? In the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, most people think like that, and Arjuna don't think like that. Trigunya Vishaya Veda Nishtrigunya Bhavarjuna. Rise above that mentality and be transcendental. Be situated in the nature of the eternal self. And so the science of Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavatam point to that goal, and then they describe how to do it. The operator's manual. How to execute the activities of the senses, the knowledge acquiring senses, the working senses, the mind, how to put the whole apparatus together in such a way it carries the soul to Krishna. There's a science. There's a science to how the machine of the material energy works, and there's a science to how spiritual progress can best be followed. So, read your Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, discuss in association of others that have a similar interest in life, and gradually make progress towards that goal. Hare Krishna. Any comments or discussion? Yes.
Well, you were talking about dreams earlier.
About which?
Dreams.
Dreams.
So, like, when our mind comes up with a nightmare, like, how does it, like, do?
How does the mind do that?
Yeah, come up with a nightmare.
Well, I explained, same way as it comes up with seeing a golden mountain. Something and something and something, and you put those somethings together and you get a nightmare. It means minimally two things. Something that's a bad activity, that the consequence of the bad activity is some suffering. So the suffering can be in a dream, or the suffering can be in waking state, or both, but it's the fruit of something, some dark activity, the result of which is some suffering within the mind in the form of a bad dream. And the other is, you know, the elements of the bad dream, the nightmare, is something and something and something that's some stored impression in the mind. Whatever those somethings are combined together, it's something that you've, those combined somethings is something you've actually experienced. But maybe not in that particular configuration, but something that you've experienced. So, what to do? That's the next question. Right? When you have a nightmare, what are you supposed to do? Well, one thing that Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita is tangstatiksha subharata. Meaning is you tolerate. You don't place merit in that. Because it's illusory. It's just a dream. As was whatever that activity was done, the dark activity in your past, it's another just illusory existence. So you don't place merit. Oh, I had this dream. Then you get all absorbed in the dream. And the dark emotion that went along with the nightmare, the bad dream. Just let go of that. Don't invest consciousness in that. And instead you invest consciousness in Sat, that which is eternal. So what that means is take your bead bag and start chanting. Or you open Bhagavad Gita and you read Bhagavad Gita, or you remember one of those nice verses that you've memorized so many of, and you bring that to your mind, or you go into your temple room and you come before the deity and you offer prayers to the deity, or you engage in one of the nine processes of bhakti. you withdraw consciousness from asat and invest consciousness in sat. Take shelter there. Because that's all, now you see it, now you don't. It's illusory. And there's the, you know, the nightmare kind, and there's the other kind. Oh, it looks very nice kind. But you know what's behind that. It looks very nice. Kamesha, Krodesha. It follows. One, two. Punch. It'll follow. Guaranteed. So just don't invest consciousness there. Withdraw it and place it over in sat. So sat means that which is eternal. And you're getting the training from childhood. What is that? Some people don't know what that is. They've heard about it, but they don't have a clear idea. And you're fortunate, you have a clear idea. The only thing that's needed is the will to do so. Because that's your choice, free will. Someone isn't going to operate your free will for you. You have free will. So you can, now you're equipped. You can choose this one or choose that one. Dark activities lead to dark impressions, lead to dark experience, subtly and grossly, both, or either or both, guaranteed. Without fail, it will happen. So then there's the daytime activity where there's, you know, some awful thing happens, besides the nightmare, a daymare. And it comes from the same thing. Some dark activity in the past. So stay away from those and go to the light. Yes?
You were talking about, most of the time I try to talk about Vedas and the Karmakanda activity, but now you are saying that it is a manual for the human body to follow.
Yes. How to put those two together? That's your question? Let me ask you a question to answer your question. What's the reason for persons, for souls, to take birth in the material world? What's the reason? Aversion to the personality of Godhead. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Raga Dvesha Samutena Dvandva Mohina Bharata, overcome by the dualities of desire and hate, coveting the position of being the enjoyer, God, because he's the enjoyer. We take birth in this world. Now take that understanding. Those who have taken birth in this world have an aversion to God being the enjoyer. Instead, they wish that they were the enjoyer. And now, you're Vyasadev, or Vyasadev has the assignment of bringing them to the position, again, of Krishna as the enjoyer. But they don't want that. That's why they're here in this world. So an indirect method is supplied. But the goal of that indirect method is to restore their rightful position. So there's an indirect method and there's a direct method. But the goal of both is the same. And that's what King Pajinibari said. They didn't tell me. Well, that's because their livelihood was to engage him in doing fruitive activities, karmakanda. If he said, oh, you don't need to do these fruitive activities, you can just do the direct method, then they're out of a job. But also, they themselves were not of proper understanding, commonly. Because as Krishna says, most people think the purpose of the Vedas is to enjoy. within the modes of nature. And they say, there's nothing more than this. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you may die. Do it nicely. But eat, drink, and be merry. In other words, as far as that which is eternal, the eternal welfare of the soul, no need to talk about it.
And the reason why I asked the question is because I was under that same impression, when we were in Chennai, but when I came here and listened to all these lectures, then only I realized, oh, there is a higher thing than the Vedas. Because we were brought up in that same mentality.
Sure. You were fortunate in that you were, the context in which you were brought up was Vedic. There are those that aren't brought up in that context, and they have the same idea, but unregulated sense gratification. Or regulated sense gratification, but sense gratification. Pious sense gratification. And there's nothing more. Or in the next life, even greater enjoyment in the heavenly realm. Salvation is commonly considered, at least in our Western culture, attain heaven and enjoy. But the idea of God's enjoyment, the language is there, but the clarity isn't. What does that mean? As opposed to my enjoyment. It's about me, not about God's enjoyment. So what if the purpose of these senses is to satisfy the senses of Krishna? That's not clear. And what does that life look like? What does it feel like? What does a culture look like? What does social interaction in that manner look like? Manusha nam sahasreshu kashchid yatati siddhaye yatatam api siddhanam kashchin mam viti tatpata. Very rare. Yes.
Yes, Maharaj, just for reinforcement, could you elaborate a little bit more on, is there an immediate process when we depart this gross body and we're transferred to our next destination, or is there some time?
Well, two things. It depends on what your destination is. And it also depends on how you think of time. Let's say, in the case of Narada, this is described in the first canto, chapter 6. Narada describes his previous life, where he practiced, he was a nobody, and he had association of saintly persons, and he became spiritually perfected. Just quick. And then he left his body. So he describes to Vyas as simultaneous as lightning and illumination. It's not lightning and thunder, but lightning and illumination. Like, there's no time delay, right? Immediately he achieved his spiritual form. That's if your destination is the spiritual destination. It's immediate. And then the answer to the other is, supposing that isn't your destination, one can say either one of two things. It's immediate. That is to say, the soul is transferred from this body to the womb of the next mother. Immediate. In fact, the Bhagavatam gives this example of an inchworm. You've seen an inchworm before? The guys with the feet in the front and the back, and he goes like this, and he's looking for the next twig and branch, and he finds one. And not until does he find one, because he doesn't jump. He then arches his back, the rear legs let go, and then the rear legs connect with the next branch. Using that as a metaphor, the Bhagavatam says, similarly, until the next destination of the soul is determined, you can't give up this present body because the connection is made at once. Transfer is at once. But time is relative. So supposing the destination is from the human form of life to a lower form of life. In the lower forms of life, time works differently. As in the higher forms of life, in the heavenly planets and Brahmaloka, time is relative. It acts differently according to consciousness. That's the Vedic picture. So supposing one's destination is down to a lower life form. Before that happens, we don't have a joy ride. We're taken to the court of Yamaraj. It's very similar to the judgment day that's described in the Bible. And Yamaraj then, knowing all the pious and impious sinful activities, indicates our next destination, to what hellish planet we're destined to go to. And for a whole lifetime, which takes place in a flash on this realm, but it's a whole lifetime in the lower planetary regions, in the hellish regions, one experiences hellish life. To the point where one is pleading, please get me out of here, I'll accept any condition, etc., etc. And then that soul is, and the subtle body are transferred into whatever life form. A worm or a bug or a tree or a bird or an animal, whatever the lower life form is. All of that happens in a flash. On this plane, there's a whole lifetime in the hellish regions. And then transfer to the next, lower than the human life form. Animal form, bird form, whatever it is, form. That's the Vedic picture of relative time.
One day.
That means the next day of Brahma is the same soul?
I don't know. Doesn't say. So I don't know. But he appeared at the beginning of Brahma's day. Very early in Brahma's day. But it's described from the previous day of Brahma, his form was spiritual. And then it describes that spiritual form was resting along with the other conditioned souls within the body of Mahavishnu, and that appeared as the son of Brahma. It doesn't say what happens after this day of Brahma. At least I've not read it. So I can't answer your question. What happens to Brahma's tomorrow? I don't know.
There are some descriptions where Narada goes to Goloka and then
even... Yeah, sure. You know from Brihad Bhagavatam. Even in the Bhagavatam, he goes to Dwaraka, which is none different than the spiritual world. And he has a passport and a visa. He has access to those realms. He goes to Vaikuntha. He's wherever he wants to go. But he only wants to go where there's some service. Not whimsical or sightseeing. It's service. That's his qualification, and that's his facility to fulfill that qualification.
It's like going to timeless divine and time the mind.
Yeah.
Changing it.
Yes. One of the things that he experiences when he goes to Dwarka is that on this plane it's the same time, but when he goes to the different palaces of Krishna, it's different times of the day, during the same time of the day. Krishna can just move time and matter however he likes. And he likes. So he moves time and matter. He goes to one palace and Krishna is worshipping. And goes to the next palace and Krishna is resting. It goes to the next palace and Krishna is playing with his children. Next palace and getting ready to go to the assembly house. And, you know, he's not limited by time. Time is under his direction. Yes?
Guru Maharaj, we've been studying from Network Instruction, and there's a particular statement that I want some clarification on. Prabhupada writes, the mind, this is text 8, the mind contains hundreds and thousands of impressions, not only of this life, but of many, many lives of the past. These impressions sometimes come in contact with one another and produce contradictory pictures. So the question was asked, what does this mean, contradictory pictures?
Like the Golden Mountain. Or flying in the sky. As I mentioned, I had a dream was, you know, that's contradictory. I've never, at least I don't remember flying in the sky. And it's certainly not in our backyard. So how does it, I, you know, I don't know. It's contradictory. Something else? Yes. How we do what?
That railway station is like how you saw a guy suffering his last moment of life, how somebody tried to offer him a cigarette and he passes like remembering his salary, right?
Okay.
I came across kind of similar incident like which I would like to share with you.
Okay.
One person was narrating me an incident that he saw on the TV. There was this 82-year-old lady. Her routine of life is she used to order pizza every day for lunch and dinner. Every day. She'd been doing that for n number of years. And like two times in a row she didn't get caught, like that night and then following day after. It's the same place she calls and the same person delivers, so it's been going on for a certain number of years. So they didn't hear from her like two times in a row, so they were wondering what's going on with that old lady. So they went, they stopped to see what's happening with her residence. They tried to ring the doorbell. She didn't answer the doorbell. They tried to knock on her door for several times, and she didn't respond. So they were forced to open, and they got into this old lady's residence. They found her. She was unconscious on the floor. So they took her to the ICU, and then they found her. She was, like, suffering from something, and then they treated her, and she was back to home, and then she called the news reporters and channel, and she said, she gave an interview, like, how pizza people saved her life. So this person was trying to argue with me. He knows that we don't eat outside and stuff like that. So he was trying to advise me, you know, you should consider ordering your food. He's kind of a bit challenging to answer the question. I answered him, but I would like to hear from you, how would you respond, like, when you come under a roof or when you meet with people like that? How would you respond?
I missed a key part of the whole narrative. When the 2 days that she was gone, what happened?
She was unconscious and she was locked inside a house.
Yeah, yeah.
The pizza people didn't.
Yeah, I got that part. When she was out cold on the floor, what was going on? Nothing? Just unconscious. So why did the person say you should order pizza? Oh. Guess we should just all order pizza. But only from that place, because only that place would they bother to go to people that didn't go back and ask for more pizza to find out what happened. Supposing it was, you know, the laundryman or something. You should get all your laundry done by the laundryman, because otherwise they could save your life. You don't. That's a nice answer. That's a nice answer. I would give a more smart aleck answer. Your logic is very faulty, my dear friend. there's a Vedic statement that says, Mari Krishna Rakhi Ke, Rakhi Krishna Mari Ke. If Krishna wants to save one, no one can harm one. If Krishna wants to harm one, no one can save him. My dependence is upon Krishna. It's the super soul in the heart of that pizza deliverer that brought them. Not just that she ate pizza. That's my faith. As this lady was interviewed, the rescue came from this instrument. It can come from that instrument or any other instrument where Krishna is within the heart of that instrument. That's my faith. And you can order pizza. That's okay. And I'm going to depend on Krishna. That's my faith. Yes.
We heard Krishna give us situations or challenges which we can handle. Is that true, or he can give us more than we can handle?
And then he can make you, help you handle it. The answer is yes. It's the first one.
So in that case, like you see, like a lot of people suffer to that extent, they take their life also. So how to understand that? Because of suffering, they take their life.
Supposing somebody is drowning and you come over in a boat and you throw them a life preserver with a rope on the end, say, grab a hold of the life preserver, and they don't grab a hold of the life preserver, who's responsible? I can say no. I don't with any, or I got, you know, I'm too unhappy to grab the life preserver. I'd rather drown. Or something. There's still free will operative in situations that we're placed in. Yes? Say it slower and clearer.
You said the devotee is materially pessimistic.
Yeah.
And,
spiritually
optimistic.
Yes.
Can you elaborate
more? I did.
I didn't get it.
Should I do it again?
Maybe
the whole class was that. You know what optimism and pessimism are. So pessimism is, I don't think that's a very good idea. So searching for happiness where there's no happiness. Dukkhalayam ashashvatam. That the nature is by design, that's the kind of place it is. I want freedom. So let me go to prison and search for freedom. I want water. Let me go into the desert and search for water. Let me come into the material realm and search for happiness. I'm pessimistic. It's not the nature of the place. So I'm not going to invest, because I'm by that pessimism, I'm not going to invest a lot of energy in looking for water in a desert, etc. Or finding happiness in fruitive activity. Although the glitter may make it look like that. I know better. From experience, the school of hard knocks, plus from hearing and seeing and experiencing, all three. And the other is, I see in the lives of those that are very sincere in practicing, their spiritual practice, genuine spiritual practice, their quality is unique. They're consistently happy people. I like that. For whatever the reasons are, I have some faith. I have faith. I have optimism. There may be some bumps in the road, some struggles, some hurdles to overcome, some obstacles. That's okay. Like that. Something else? Okay. Yes. How do you prove your attraction for Krishna? I bet you know the answer. Let me suggest an answer that I know that you already know. Read Krishna book. Chant with attention. Because the Krishna's nature, the name Krishna means all-attractive. So how do we become attracted to the all-attractive? You bring your consciousness to the all-attractive. Become acquainted with the all-attractive. And you become attracted. Your lively son. You'd like him to become attracted to Krishna. So, read Krishna book. And he's, you know, moving around and doing the pralad, but his, by hearing, he'll become attracted because Krishna is all attractive. And he'll come and ask you, Mommy, read this one. And you can read it 100 times and he'll come and, you know, read it again because he's attracted. And at least for those minutes where he's sitting listening to Krishna, he'll become more peaceful because Krishna is all attractive. You've had experience like that? Reading Krishna book to him? He has his favorite stories. Read that one. You can give him a menu. And he'll tell you right away, I want that one. Isn't it? Okay. So, from that experience, then you can deduce how you can become more attracted to Krishna. By hearing about him. By attentively chanting his name. By bringing your consciousness to the all-attractive, you become attracted. And getting the clarity of what is that attractiveness from the descriptions of our acharyas found in their purports or commentary. By absorption in the hearing process, simply. That's the best means. And through service, doing things for Krishna helps develop our attraction for him. The reciprocation of love helps us become attracted to someone. So make your offerings when you cook every day, more than one time a day, I'm sure. Make those offerings with love. And that will help develop your attraction for Krishna. Through an extension of your feelings of love to him. It's striving like that in any case. Okay. Yes. Devotional service for Krishna.
Sometimes there are services which we may not like to do.
I know all about that. I'm answering in a personal, responding in a personal way. Not about you, about me. The things that I don't like to do. I can tell you about them someday. You've seen some of them at the GBC meetings. Yes. And so?
So, how do we, if they send us to do the service, like we have natures, and we should engage whatever our information and service. So, I'm just thinking, but some situations and circumstances, we have to do the devotional service that we do not like to do.
Yes. You place something higher than what I like to do. And there's something that's This is what I do. This is something that's very important. Therefore I do it. Here's an example from Nectar Devotion. Very simple example. The son of one of Krishna's sons is Pradyumna. So it's described. He's an example given by Rupa Goswami of Dasya Rasa. And Dasya Rasa, which is the preliminary rasa, if Krishna wanted something, and Pradyumna didn't want that something, he would do that something because Krishna wanted that something. And then conversely, if Pradyumna wanted something, and Krishna didn't want that something, he would just give it up. Because he wanted to do it, you know, wanted to please Krishna. That's Dasya Rasa. So out of Dasya, it may not be my nature. That's okay. If it's pleasing to Krishna, that's my constitutional nature, not my conditional nature. So let me come to that position where, you know, to some degree, that in other words, Krishna will engage me in doing some of the things I also like to do. But what Krishna really wants is my heart. I learned a very nice lesson in the first 3 weeks of living in a temple. Let me narrate the story. It's short. I came directly from a college to the Boston Temple. That was the temple that I joined. And when I came in to the temple, you know, college graduate, on to medical school, but I was in a position of a leave of absence from my education. And they needed a pot washer. So they engaged me in washing pots. And being, you know, a smarty pants college student, I was thinking, you know, don't they recognize what they got here? I can do a lot more things than wash pots. In my mind. I didn't say it, but that was what my mind was doing. But I was, you know, being conscientious and washing the pot. They said, oh, you're doing such a good job. You should just keep doing the pots. And then every day, the devotees would very joyfully load up in the Sankirtan van and go downtown and Harinam Sankirtan. And I watched them all go and the dust would settle and I think, you know, I want to go on Sankirtan. But I was washing pots. And then one devotee said, he patted me on the back, said, you're doing a very nice job. Prabhupada said, when you wash the pots, you're simultaneously cleansing your heart. This is very nice. So my little college brain said, not to them, but in my mind, oh yeah, well, how come you're not here, you know, cleansing your heart? But I thought, okay, Prabhupada said this, let me apply it. Let me meditate on cleansing my heart. I stopped the, you know, yada 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 thing, and I started applying what I heard Prabhupada said. Let me cleanse my heart. And I found it was true. And so I was getting inspired by that which I didn't want to do. Cleanse, you know, the activity is what I didn't want to do. I wanted to go on Sankirtan, but cleaning the pots. Then another devotee patted me on the back and said, Prabhupada said you should wash the pots so thoroughly that you can see your reflection in the pot. And this was at a time when we didn't have any money, so the pots were all these old, used pots, like black as can be in the bottom. And I found out later it meant, you know, the inside of the pot where the food goes, but I was trying to make the pot at the bottom. You could see your reflection in the bottom of the pot. You know, the fire part. And then I realized you can't do it just in one scrub-a-dub. It's you know, a whole series of, you know, it took days and days and days, and finally, you could see your reflection in the bottom of every pot. And someone tapped me on the shoulder and said, we got another person to wash the pots, come on with us when Sankirtan. And I realized from that experienced, and it's carried over until today. What Krishna really wanted was my heart. Just surrender unto me. And then whatever that which was more according to my nature, Krishna provided that service. But he first wanted my heart. Do it with your heart, not just get what you want. And call it spiritual. It was a nice lesson. And, you know, it's helped me. When other situations arise where I'm asked to do things that I don't like them. Somebody else can be GBC for the next couple of decades and I'll be happy. Go to those meetings and you know what it's like because you've seen. So it's not everything, you know, the intelligence needs to discriminate. It's not everything that I don't like I should do. It's just, you know, but on the other side, don't just everything I don't do because I don't like. And I just do the things I like. Because in my estimation, it's my nature. But something that's needed. And also when it's something that's coming in a directed fashion, there's, you know, what's Krishna want in this situation? Anyway. Okay. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.